Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, so if you're an artist, maybe a songwriter, producer, really anyone creating music, right? Chances are pretty high, actually, that you might be leaving money, maybe significant money, and definitely legal protection sort of exposed. Today we are diving deep, really deep, into how you get paid royalties and also the legal side, how you protect yourself when inevitably someone copies or steals your work. Yeah, our sources today, they're essential. It's coming from a top music attorney laying out the seven biggest mistakes, common ones, costly ones. And our mission really is to give you that shortcut. Stop you making these errors. We'll build up to the number one mistake, which is this fundamental misunderstanding, honestly, between getting paid and actually like protecting your stuff, your intellectual property.
It really is. It's classic knowing the system versus just, submitting some forms online. And just to set the stage, when we talk about PROs, we mean performance rights organizations. So in the U.S., think ASCAP, BMI, the big ones. But while we're using U.S. examples, ASCAP, BMI, these rules, these principles, they're pretty much global. You'll find similar organizations doing the same job in, well, every major country.
Okay, and let's be super clear on the money part here, because royalty, that word gets thrown around a lot. It covers a lot of ground.
Exactly. PROs, specifically, they collect performance royalties. Performance. So think about when your music is performed publicly. Radio play, obviously. But also streaming Spotify, Apple Music, those interactive ones. Or even played in a bar, a shop, a gym. That's a public performance. And it's really important for you listening to grasp this. That's only one slice of the royalty pie. Just one. You've also got mechanical royalties, physical sales, downloads, even some stream payments. Different organizations handle those. Today, we're zeroing in on performance rights because honestly, that's where these procedural mistakes we're going to unpack, that's where they cause the biggest, most immediate hit to your income.
Right. And what's really interesting, I saw this in the notes, is that even this landscape, performance royalties, it's shifting. Like maybe big changes are coming.
Yes, absolutely. The attorney mentioned they're watching government actions really closely. Because there's serious talk, it's speculation, okay, but informed speculation about maybe a quote, whole new type of royalty or just a whole new way for artists to get paid, probably trying to adapt to AI, how streaming platforms actually make money now, and that changing landscape. It just makes knowing the current rules more critical, not less, because the people who are organized now, registered properly, who understand how it works today, they'll be first in line when or if a new system comes along. They'll benefit first.
That makes total sense. Okay, let's get into it then. Let's unpack these procedural errors. We're working backwards, starting with number seven. Small mistakes, potentially huge consequences, right? So mistake number seven. It sounds basic, but it's all about the clock. Timing.
Timing. It's probably the easiest one to avoid, theoretically. Yet it happens constantly. And it's costly. The core issue. Just waiting too long. Waiting too long after your music is out there to actually register it with your PRO. Let's imagine, okay, you drop a track today. Get some traction, maybe, I don't know, 200,000 streams in the first year. Pretty good. But you're busy, you're creating, you put off registering with, say, ASCAP. You wait maybe 18 months?
Okay, so 18 months of streams, that's real usage, real money being generated somewhere. Where does it go if I haven't registered?
Well, that money often ends up in what's sometimes called the black box, or
Yeah.
maybe a suspense account. Basically, funds that have been collected but aren't matched to an owner yet. Now, when you finally register 18 months down the line, you can only collect royalties from that point forward, from the registration date onward. You do not get paid retroactively for those 18 months of streams and plays. All that money, it's essentially gone, from your perspective anyway. Unrecoverable through the PRO system because they generally don't backdate payments that far.
Wait, hang on. If the money's sitting there in suspense, why can't they just match it up once I register? It seems like they should be able to figure it out.
You'd think so, right? But the system just isn't built for large-scale retroactive matching like that. Think about the scale. They're processing billions, literally billions, of data points every day. Streams, radio plays, everything. The rule of thumb for PROs is if you weren't registered, if you weren't actively claiming it when the usage happened, those funds eventually get distributed. They get paid out to other rights holders who were registered, usually based on their market share. So the big players tend to absorb it. It's a critical missed opportunity. Registering your track immediately when it's released, maybe even slightly before, it's just non-negotiable if you want every single dollar you've earned.
Wow. That's potentially a lot of money just vanishing because you procrastinated. Okay. So moving to mistake number six, let's say you do get around to registering. Artists then stumble over the actual submission. Like, what do the PROs actually need from you?
Oh, this is a classic. Confusing the metadata with the actual media. the music file itself. So artists go to register their song, right? And they think, okay, I need to upload my track. And they try to upload the WAV file or a big MP3, maybe 50, 100 megabytes. Imagine the strain on their servers if everyone did that. The PROs do not need your audio file for registration. They don't want it. Trying to upload it often just causes the submission to fail or get stuck or flagged.
Okay, so no audio file. What do they need then?
Metadata.
Yeah.
Just the data about the song. And this is absolutely crucial because this text data is what their computer systems use to mash things up. So that means the song title, obviously, the duration, the length of the track, critically, the names of all the authors, the creators, the writers, composers, and their splits. You know, who owns what percentage?
Yeah.
PRO is basically looking for text identifiers. They use this info to match the usage data they get from Spotify or the radio station back to your claim. They need the text, not the sound.
And this connects back to what the distributor does, right? You mentioned ISRC codes earlier. Maybe quickly define what that is and why it's so key for the PRO.
Yes, vital connection. ISRC. It stands for International Standard Recording Code. Think of it as a unique digital fingerprint for a specific recording. Not the song, the recording. It's a 12-character code. Your distributor, like DistroKid, TuneCore, CD Baby, whoever you use, they assign one ISRC to every single track you release. One code per song version. Now, when Spotify, for instance, reports usage data to ASCAP or BMI, they report plays linked to that ISRC. The PRO's system then takes that ISRC and tries to match it to the metadata you submitted, song title, writers, duration. If your metadata is wrong or incomplete, or if you tried to upload an audio file instead, that link is broken, the matching fails, and the payment can't be processed. Simple as that.
Okay, that clicks. Distributor handles the audio and gets it out there with an ISRC. The PRO uses that ISRC and your submitted metadata to track the rights and send the money.
Precisely. Got in one.
All right. Mistake number five. This one feels a bit more nuanced. It's for the producers, the beat makers. They're often in this kind of limbo, like, when exactly should they register their tracks?
Yeah, this causes endless confusion. And it really depends on the purpose and the status of that music. The general rule, the guiding principle is, you register music when you want to collect performance royalties on the final released version of a song, the version the public is actually hearing. So let's take scenario one. You're a producer making, let's call them draft beats. You crank out, say, 100 beats a month. The intention is that a singer, a rapper, someone, is going to add a top line vocals, melody later on. These are like track beds, right? Not finished songs yet. In this case, you typically do not need to register those instrumental beats yet. Why not? Well, first, they aren't really the final intellectual property yet. And second, registering them now creates a massive administrative headache later. Because when the final song is done with vocals, it'll likely have a different title, maybe new co-writers, the vocalists. You have to amend the original registration, or worse, have duplicate registrations. It gets messy.
So for those kinds of beats, you wait until the track is totally finished, mixed, mastered, got its ISRC, ready to go out to the world.
Exactly. Wait for the final released version. But, and this is a huge but, for many modern creators, there's a crucial exception. Let's say you're a producer, but your entire vibe, your whole artistic output, is instrumental music. Maybe you make lo-fi hip-hop beats for setting, or electronic tracks, or film score cues. And you release these instrumentals as finished products. They're intended for people to stream, to listen to directly. They're generating performance royalties right away. In that case, yes, you absolutely do need to register those instrumentals immediately upon release because they are the final marketable song-generating plays. So you have to distinguish, is this a beat waiting for a vocalist? Or is this a finished instrumental track ready for the public? That's the key difference.
Okay. Critical distinction there. Drafts, wait, final instrumentals get registered now.
You've got it.
Mistake number four feels purely administrative, but sounds like it could totally jam up the works, especially for album artists. It's about registering albums versus songs.
Oh, happens all the time. An artist puts out, say, a 10-song album. They think, logically perhaps, this is one project, one body of work. I'll submit one registration for the album.
Yeah.
They ask, can I just register the whole album at once? And the answer, the attorney was very clear, is unequivocally no. You cannot. You must register each song individually, one at a time. If your album has 10 songs, that means 10 separate registrations with the PRO.
But wait, even if, say, all 10 songs have the exact same writers and the same publishing info, why can't I just batch them? It feels inefficient to do it 10 times.
It feels inefficient from the user side, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But the system on the back end relies on tracking unique individual assets. Remember the ISRC? Your distributor already assigned 10 different ISRC codes, one for each track on that album. Each song is its own distinct piece of intellectual property in the eyes of the tracking systems. if you try to register the album as just one item called, you know, My Awesome Album, how can the PRO match the incoming data? Spotify is reporting streams for track 3 with its ISRC and track 7 with its ISRC. They can't match that detailed data back to one single album registration file. And think about it, the royalties can be wildly different per track, right? Track 3 might be a massive hit, gets 10 million streams. Track 7 might be an album cut with only 10,000 streams. Registering song by song ensures the PRO can accurately allocate the royalties based on the specific usage of each track. They can isolate the hit and pay correctly instead of trying to average out payments across an entire bundle.
Okay, yeah, the granularity is key. The distributor sets up 10 unique tracks, so the PRO needs 10 unique registrations to pay out correctly.
Exactly right. 10 inputs need 10 outputs.
Okay, last one in this section, mistake number 3. This gets into the slightly sticky area of samples. Disclosure. Artists seem to mess this up by either saying too much or not saying enough.
Yeah, this one hinges on understanding what actually counts as a sample that needs declaring to the PRO during registration. The sources were really clear. If you're using stuff like purchase loops, maybe from Splice or some other library, or generic royalty-free sample packs, you usually do not need to tick the box saying, this song contains samples.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because those sounds are typically pre-cleared. Your license to use that loop pack covers the usage. Declaring them just adds unnecessary paperwork.
So buying an 80s synth pack doesn't mean I report every synth stab I use.
Yeah.
When do I need to disclose? When is it mandatory?
Disclosure is mandatory when you are sampling a distinct, recognizable piece of existing, copyrighted intellectual property. Music that's already out there, already registered, clearly belongs to someone else. The only time you should be selecting that contains samples option during registration is when there's been a formal deal, a license agreement, an arrangement where you've specifically agreed to sample, say, a vocal hook or a guitar riff or a drum break from a known existing song. Like if you say, okay, I'm sampling the opening bars of that famous funk track from the 70s, and we actually negotiated a license with the original publisher, that's when you disclose it to the PRO. If you just start declaring every generic loop you bought, you're just creating red tape. The PRO might halt payments while they investigate the sample you declared, even though there was nothing to investigate. It just slows everything down.
So the simple rule is, if you didn't need to get specific permission or sign a split sheet for using that sound, don't report it as a sample to the PRO.
That's probably the easiest way to think about it, yeah. Keep it simple unless a formal sample license is involved.
Okay, we've navigated those first 5 pitfalls. Timing, metadata, producer issues, album registration, samples, mostly procedural stuff. Now we hit mistake number 2, and this one.
Yeah.
This one is huge financially. This is the oversight that potentially cuts an independent artist's performance income in half. The publishing paradox.
Absolutely. This is a big one. The core issue, the paradox, is this widespread belief among indie artists that they need someone else, that they need an external publisher, they have to set up a whole separate company, like an LLC, to act as their publisher, just to collect the publishing share of their royalties. Artists hear publisher and they get intimidated, maybe think it's only for major label acts. So they don't claim that part of the money. They leave half of it sitting there.
Okay, wait, back up slightly. Why are there even 2 shares? What's the basic concept behind splitting the royalty dollar?
Right, good question. Traditionally, performance royalties are divided into 2 main halves, the writer's share and the publisher's share. Typically, it's a 50-50 split. Conceptually, the writer's share goes directly to the person or people who actually wrote the song, the melody, the lyrics, the creative part. The publisher's share goes to the entity responsible for managing the song administration, licensing it out, promoting it, collecting the money, the business side. Now, for an independent artist, if you don't have a separate publisher doing that work, well, then you are effectively acting as your own publisher. But here's the catch. If you don't go onto the PRO's platform and explicitly tell them you're collecting the publisher's share, that 50% often just stays unclaimed. It gets lost in the system or eventually redistributed, just like we discussed with the timing mistake.
So what's the solution then? Do they actually need to hire someone or form a company?
No. That's the paradox. They don't. The artists themselves can collect both shares, both halves. The actionable step is surprisingly simple. You just log into your PRO account, ASCAMAPI, BMI, whoever, find the right section when you register your song, and declare that you are collecting all of the publishing. You're essentially telling them, hey, I wrote this, and I'm handling the business side myself. You claim both the writer's share and the publisher's share directly.
Wow. That immediately doubles your potential income from performance royalties right there. That's staggering. Now, you mentioned this gets even trickier because the main PROs, ASCAP and BMI, they actually count this differently. The math isn't the same.
Exactly. And this detail is incredibly important because it affects the actual numbers you see on your royalty statement, how much cash hits your account. We have to look at how each of them accounts for the total publishing pie, as they sometimes call it. Let's start with ASCAP. ASCAP keeps it pretty straightforward. They calculate the total pie on a 100% basis. So imagine the total royalty for one stream or play is, say, $1. ASCAP divides that. 50 cents is the writer's share, 50 cents is the publisher's share. Together, that makes 100% of the dollar. If you, as the writer, are collecting both shares through ASCAP, you just claim 100% of the publishing. Simple. You get the whole dollar accounted for under that 100% structure.
Okay, ASCAP is 100%. Makes sense. You claim the whole thing.
Right. Now, BMI decided, as the attorney put it, to be cute about it. They decided to tally everything on a 200% basis. Try to visualize it like this. ASCAP has one pie cut in half, 50-50. BMI imagines two identical pies. There's one full 100% pie designated entirely as the writer's share. And then there's a second separate identical 100% pie designated entirely as the publisher share. So when they add it up for their internal accounting, the total potential claim is 200%. 100% for writer, 100% for publisher.
Hold on. 200%. Yeah. So if I register with BMI and I correctly claim both share, I say I'm the writer and I'm collecting the publishing, am I actually collecting double compared to just claiming the writer's share?
According to their math, yes. If you register correctly with BMI, stating you collect both writer and publisher shares, your total royalty payout will reflect that 200% structure. You get the writer's 100% plus the publisher's 100%. If you fail to claim that publisher share on BMI, you only collect the writer's 100% portion. You completely miss out on that entire second 100% publisher pie. Let's try numbers again. If BMI decides a radio play is worth, say, 5 cents total, they might account for that internally as two potential claims. A 2.5 cent writer claim, which they call 100%, and a 2.5 cent publisher claim, another 100%. If you don't claim the publishing, you only get the 2.5 cents associated with the writer's 100%. You leave the other 2.5 cents on the table. This failure to claim the full publishing share, combined with this really confusing 100% vs 200% math difference between the major PROs, that's why this is the second biggest, most costly mistake. It's an easy fix once you know, but being ignorant of it, it's financially devastating for independent artists.
Okay, wow. We've covered timing, bad data, producer confusion, album issues, sample reporting, and that massive publishing share mistake that costs artists real money. Now we get to it. The number one mistake. And this one. This isn't just about lost income. This is about your fundamental rights, your legal standing. This is the mistake that, frankly, makes lawyers get involved. It exposes your entire career.
This is the big one. The attorney called it the awful ASCAP BMI protects my rights myth. And it is so pervasive. So many artists, maybe most artists starting out, genuinely believe that because they went online, they filled out the forms, they registered their songs with ASCAP or BMI, they think they're done. They think they've secured their copyright. They believe the PRO registration protects their legal rights to the song. That assumption, that's the dangerous part. That's what leads to legal disaster down the road.
They think ticking the get paid box also ticks the legal protection box, but they're totally separate things.
Totally separate. We need absolute clarity here. It's crucial. PRO registration, ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, that is purely a financial mechanism. It's about collection. It only helps you collect your performance royalties. That's its job. Copyright protection, actually owning and being able to defend your intellectual property, that is a legal mechanism. It's a function of federal law. It's handled entirely separately by the U.S. Copyright Office. That's copyright.gov. You have to deal with the government's legal system for protection, not just the royalty collection agency.
So what happens if an artist skips that second step? They register with BMI, they collect some streaming money, but they never go to copyright.gov. Why is that official registration so vital? What power does it actually give you?
Okay, registering with the Copyright Office gives you critical additional legal rights. And honestly, these rights are the only real weapons you have if someone steals your music. And eventually, someone probably will try. Official copyright registration is what empowers you legally to actually do something about it, to file an infringement lawsuit in federal court, to sue the people who stole your work, and importantly, to seek meaningful remedies.
Okay, meaningful remedies. What specific things can you not get easily if you haven't registered with the Copyright Office? What financial damages are off the table?
Right, without that timely federal registration, your ability to recover financially is severely hampered. Two huge things become very difficult, if not impossible, to claim. First, attorney's fees, meaning if you haven't registered correctly and on time, you generally can't make the person who stole your music pay for your lawyer. you have to fund the lawsuit yourself up front. That's a massive barrier for most independent artists. Lawyers are expensive. Second, and this is huge, statutory damages.
Statutory damages. Explain that. Why is that so important?
Statutory damages are basically the hammer in copyright law. If you haven't registered your copyright properly before the infringement or within a specific window, you're usually stuck trying to prove actual damages. That means you have to calculate, down to the penny, exactly how much money you lost because they stole your song. How many sales did you lose? How much did they profit? It's incredibly complex, expensive, and often impossible to prove accurately. But if you have registered your copyright correctly and on time, the law allows you to ask the court for statutory damages instead. These are preset amounts defined by the law. The judge can award them even if you can't prove specific financial harm. And these aren't trivial amounts. We're talking, depending on the details and whether the infringement was willful, figures ranging from $750 up to $150,000 per infringed work.
Wow. Up to $150,000 per song they stole. Okay, that completely changes the calculation for a lawyer thinking about taking your case, right? Fundamentally changes it. Statutory damages are those big chunks of damages, as the attorney called them. They make pursuing legal action economically viable. They're crucial not just for compensating you, but for deterring theft in the first place. If infringers know you haven't registered, they know the potential penalty is low, maybe just your actual hard-to-prove damages, they might risk it. But if they know you have registered, they know they could be facing six-figure statutory damages plus your attorney fees. Suddenly, stealing your music looks like a very bad business decision.
This sounds like there's a timing element here, too, a real trap. If someone rips off my song, can't I just quickly go to copyright.gov, register it then, and then file the lawsuit?
Oh, that's the absolute danger. That's why this is mistake number one. If you wait until after you discover someone has infringed your copyright to rush and register it, it's often too late. Too late specifically to get those powerful remedies, especially statutory damages and attorney's fees. To have the strongest possible legal position, the law generally requires you to register your copyright either before the infringement begins or within 3 months of the work's first publication release. If you miss that window, you can still register later, sure, and you can still sue. But your legal options become much more limited. Pursuing the case gets very expensive, as the attorney said, because you're likely paying your own lawyer and fighting for potentially smaller, harder-to-prove damages. This is why this point was stressed above all others. PRO registration. Yes, absolutely necessary to get paid performance royalties. But Federal Copyright Office registration. That's necessary for your legal survival. It's your shield, your sword. And you need it in place before the battle starts. #tagoutro.
Okay, so we've covered a huge amount of ground. From tiny administrative details like metadata all the way up to the absolute bedrock of your legal rights as a creator, it really comes down to two essential pillars, doesn't it? You need timely, correct royalty collection, that's the PRO registration part, and you need ironclad legal defense, that's the Federal Copyright Office registration. You absolutely need both done right.
Yeah, if you boil it all down, the single biggest, most dangerous mistake is failing to grasp that fundamental difference. Confusing the money collection system, PROs, with the legal protection system, Copyright Office. Making that mistake basically leaves your creative work vulnerable, potentially offered up for grabs with very little you can effectively do about it. It's the costliest error because it undermines everything else.
And to wrap up, there was this really provocative thought in the source material connecting this need for legal protection to something very current, very real, the Indie AI lawsuit. What should listeners really take away from the threat of AI regarding their IP?
Right, the attorney brought this up. There are ongoing class action lawsuits involving independent artists. And the core issue, the really shocking part, is that some major companies have basically admitted it. They've admitted to training their generative AI models, the AIs that create new music, new text, new images, by feeding them vast amounts of existing creative work, including music scraped from platforms like Spotify, Apple Music, SoundCloud, you name it.
Wow. So just by having my music available for people to stream, it might have been hoovered up by an AI company and used to teach their algorithm how to make music like mine, essentially training my competition using my own work.
That's exactly the implication. The threat is massive. First, they might generate stuff that directly competes with you, maybe even sounds suspiciously like you. But second, the use of your music as training data itself, without permission or compensation, that's the core of these lawsuits. And this brings it all home. In this rapidly evolving digital world where threats like AI data scraping are huge, potentially invisible, the need for official government-backed copyright registration is more critical than ever. It's not just about someone covering your song anymore. You might think you're just protecting against some small-time infringement, but now you could be up against giant tech companies using your work on an industrial scale. Securing that federal copyright registration, it's no longer just about getting paid for radio play. It's about defending the fundamental integrity and value of your creative work against these massive technologically driven challenges. It's about future-proofing your rights. That's the number one challenge and why you absolutely cannot afford to skip that crucial number one step.
A truly powerful and frankly slightly scary thought to end on. If you haven't secured that official copyright protection, the time to look into it is definitely now. Thank you for joining us for the deep dive.